and welcome to Scriptlock, a laid-back discussion on writing and storytelling in video games. I'm your host, Nick Folkman.
And I am Max Folkman. Today's guests are Chris Brown and Brad Meir. Chris has an astounding career with over 20 years of experience working as a VO, on-set, and casting director, along with being a creative strategic consultant. Her run at LucasArts ran from Sam and Max Hit the Road through Grim Fandango, after which she started KBA Voice Productions and went on to work for such clients as Lucasfilm on the Star Wars prequels, EA, THQ, Ubisoft, where she was the lead of the narrative talent group at Ubisoft Montreal, and Double Fine, where she has done all of the voice casting and direction, and most recently she's been working with Telltale. Brad started out as a programmer at Outrage Games on Alter Echo, followed by a move to Raven Software for X-Men Legends, and then Double Fine for Psychonauts, Brutal Legend, where he was a designer, and Iron Brigade, Brazen, and Master Chalice, which he was all the project lead on. And currently, he is days away from moving to the Pacific Northwest to work at Valve. Hope that was right, everybody.
I think you nailed it. Yeah.
Yeah, you
got it. That's well laid out. Did you rehearse
Excellent.
That? Was that rehearsed?
No, I've gotten to the point now where I just write down exactly what I'm going to say early, so I don't need to think about it.
My first project was actually Monkey Island, but that was close.
Okay, I'll fix that, even though I'm never going to... I'm not going to edit this and repost a new version.
No, don't. It's good. Now they have it.
Oh my God, that is so rad, Chris.
I don't know.
You just worked on like all those adventure games, like all of them.
What? But I didn't make Master Chalice and rad shit like that, man.
Okay, Chris will be a longer intro, so I think Brad will start with how you broke in first.
Sure. I don't know. I like went to school to be a programmer because I didn't know what to do, which I think happens to some people. I kind of fell into like engineering. I went to University of Michigan and I got a computer engineering degree. And then I'm trying to think of how exactly I ended up at Outrage. I did an internship at High Voltage. So like through a professor, I found out that, you know, you could actually maybe get a job as a game programmer. That was like a thing. It's really funny now. Like, I feel like there's so much information on like how you would break into the industry. But back then, I guess that was about 99, 2000. That information just like wasn't out there, so you kind of had to really like dig for it and try to figure it out, especially like being in the Midwest in Michigan. But this professor kind of hooked me up with this internship in Chicago, so I did like 3 months at High Voltage Software, and we were just kind of working on like generic stuff for the engine, just kind of like small stuff that was probably eventually thrown away. I think it was like the UI system for that. And then after that, I graduated and I was like looking for a full-time gig, and I found Outrage Games, which is like, they were right in Ann Arbor, right where they were literally across the street from where I was living at the time, which was super weird. And I applied, they were hiring like entry-level programmers, and I applied and got the gig cold. It was awesome. I worked on Alter Echo. That was like the first game I did like player controls and combat. Primarily some tools work as well, and I don't know, I just really liked it. It's super rewarding, super hard work, but it was cool. As soon as we finished that, THQ shut it down. That was like one of the most exciting and sad days of my career. Was like Alter Echo went gold, and they were like, hey, like it went gold, like it's, you know, it'll be on shelves in 3 weeks or whatever. And by the way, the studio is closed. Like, that's it. So everybody's got to get out. We're like, oh, somewhat bittersweet. So after that, I kind of like did an interview circuit and ended up at Raven Software in Madison. I worked on X-Men Legends. I was only there for a few months because like Double Fine lost my resume or something. And then I guess they found it. And they were like, hey, we really need gameplay programmers. So I decided to... kind of pull the ripcord on Raven. I felt really bad about it at the time, but they were super cool with it. And, you know, I think it was definitely, you know, in retrospect, it was the right call. So landed in San Francisco, working with Tim. And so I was a gameplay programmer on Psychonauts, and then transitioned to be a designer on Brutal Legend. And then during Brutal Legend, we did the very first Amnesia Fortnite at Double Fine, and Tim.
Could you explain what amnesia is for people?
Oh yeah. So this is like Tim had this idea that, you know, he didn't want Double Fine to be just like the Tim Game Studio. Like, he wanted it to be this more like, I don't know, like creative haven for people where like other people could get to make their games too. So he brought it from a film director, this idea that you sort of stop what you're doing in the middle and then make some like stuff that's totally unrelated to like the big project that you're working on, and then you come back and finish the big project that you're working on. And it kind of reinvigorates everybody and gets, also it's a good way to test out other project leads. So we shut down work on Brutal Legend for 2 full weeks, split the company into like 4 groups, and then 4 people were selected to be project leaders. And then you had to make like a playable prototype within those 2 weeks, and you know you had a chunk of the company, and it was just an awesome experience. It was super crazy and a lot of work, and you know, it's like Brutal Legend was a lot of work, and then we just kind of went into that, and it was also a lot of work, but it was cool just switching gears and doing something completely different. So the prototype that we got there ended up being what turned into Trenched and got renamed to Iron Brigade. So that was cool. Like once Brutal Legend wrapped up, we had these prototypes, and the sequel was not gonna go. So we had these prototypes laying around from these Amnesia Fortnites that we had done, and so we just started pitching them. And that was crazy too, because I didn't know how to do that. Walking into like a boardroom of people that are all like looking grumpy and having to like tell them why they should pay you to make your game is a little bit intimidating when you don't know what you're doing. But yeah, we pitched Trenched. It was called Trenched at the time. Pitched it to a bunch of people. And then Microsoft signed it, and so I was the lead on that game, and that was super cool. It's like a mech shooter, tower defense hybrid kind of game, and yeah, we put that out. I don't know what year that shit, probably 2010, 2011, something like that. And then after that, tried to get this game called Brazen signed. Tried really, really hard. That was kind of like a westernized take on Monster Hunter through the lens of like a Ray Harryhausen film. So it's like all stop motion creatures, and just tons of potential in that idea, but we just couldn't really land that one. So it was released as just kind of like a prototype that people could play and check out. And then after that, we put that on the shelf, and then Tim was like, "Hey, like, you got any other ideas?" And I was like, "I've got this fantasy XCOM kind of hybrid idea where everybody gets old and dies." And he's like, "Sold." So we kickstarted that thing, and that was Massive Chalice. And it was, that was a great experience, like being able to work with the public and, make that video game. And then, and Chris Brown did the voice production for it. It was awesome. The only voice characters in the game are the Massive Chalice itself. It's 2 characters, like a male and a female. And yeah, they kind of train you up. They're like your advisors. They kind of train you up and, give you hints and explain the story to you and stuff like that. And it was written by you guys, Nick and Max Folkman. Tim had helped out with the writing on Iron Brigade, but with Massive Chalice, he was doing Broken Age, and so we needed to start contracting writers. So we kind of did like an open audition. It's not really an audition. What do you call that? It was like a writing test.
Yeah.
And a bunch of people took it, and I had met you guys in the past, and I knew you were hungry for work, and I knew we couldn't pay you a lot of money, so I was like, let's do it. And it turned out to be like a really, really great decision. And I think you guys did a great job, like writing all the dialogue and the random events, kind of like story nuggets throughout the game. And now I guess that takes us to like now. I just quit my job. So I don't work at Double Fine anymore, and I took a gig at Valve, so I'm going to be going up there, and just, I don't really know what I'm going to be doing up there yet, but it seems like kind of a crazy, interesting place, and we just had a baby, so we're just kind of looking to retreat to the suburbs and just, just try something new.
So excited to see what's going to come up next, especially because Gibson, your son, is the cutest baby on the planet.
Oh my God, he's so cute. I'm really, really enamored with him. He is the best. I love him. He rules.
Before we get to Chris, I want to have a follow-up question for Brad. I want to know, like, how do you pitch a game to different companies? Because we haven't heard anyone else talk about this before.
Oh, man, it's a crazy process. So we put together, like, a PowerPoint deck which is, God, everyone calls it a deck. I don't know where that comes from. But yeah, a PowerPoint presentation is called a deck, like your deck of slides. I think it comes from like really old presentations when you would actually have a physical deck. Is that
HyperCard?
Oh, HyperCard. Okay. I thought it predated like software. But so you have a deck and you just try to like explain your game the best way you can in a very straightforward, simple manner, and you're trying to also like you're trying to create a lot of excitement. I got a lot of advice from Tim during this process where he's like, you know, he's very much a story guy. So his take on it is that the best pitches are stories. They have the best stories to them. So, when we took the Massive Chalice pitch, is a little bit different because it wasn't like going to a publisher, but you know, the story was that we couldn't sign this other game and that's why we're coming to the public. And you know, you can really, like, if you watch that video again, you can really see that there's this like kind of narrative through line of, you know, why you should be interested in this thing and why it's different, why it's unique, and why, you know, it's like, I think it answers a lot of the questions that you have that they're like embedded in the story. So, yeah, trying to think about how we did that with the other games. I don't know. I don't know if we were as successful. Like, I feel like Massive Chalice had a really distinct kind of story to go with it. But yeah, that was always one of Tim's big things, is that if you can make it a story of like why you want to make this game. I think actually Tasha Harris was the lead on Costume Quest, and hers had a great story. It was like the game, like she's just such a huge Halloween fan. It's like her favorite holiday, and she'd wanted to make this game since she was like 8, and had, you know, so she had notebooks full of ideas for this game since she was a little kid. And so, you know, you can just put all that stuff into the deck as like the main hook right up front, and it really sells people on like the story of why you want to make this thing. You know, so that I think that's a big part of it. But then you're also, people make fun of this, and I it sounds really douchey, but pillars of your game, I think, are one of the most, it's a really great concept for getting your ideas across in a very succinct way. So publishers talk about this stuff all the time, but it's basically like pick the roughly like 3 to 5 things that are the most important aspect of what your game is trying to do. And so those can be anything like player customization is really important. So like, that's a pillar. Or like in Massive Chalice, the timeline, the epic timeline, the fact that it's like, oh, it's a 300 year thing. Like, that's a unique feature of the game. And that's something that we want to be a pillar that the game is built on. You can just kind of like list those out up front to give people an idea of like, this is what the game's all about. And then that's usually how I structure these things, is that right up front you talk about the pillars and the inspirations, and then you take time to like break down each pillar and sort of just give an overview of like why that thing's important and how you're going to go about how you're going to go about like making that a reality and a big piece of the game. And then usually you wrap it up with some financial stuff at the back. You sort of like tell them like why it's going to be like the best game, or like how is it going to be so great. And then at the end you're like, and this is how much it will cost, and this is how much we project that it will make. And you want to make sure that your projected amount of money that it will make is more than it costs to make it. And then that makes it attractive, hopefully. But also, they're going to do their own stuff. They call it like comps, where they pull a bunch of numbers for competitive games that they see that are competitive. And then they will look at what those games have historically made, and then they'll make the determination based on that. Like, also, there's a lot of like luck involved. There's a lot of portfolio slotting that happens at publishers. So, you know, let's say Activision will look at their kind of upcoming releases for the next 2 or 3 years, and they'll be like, oh, we have a slot for like an action game in, or like a first person shooter in the summer. You know, like, we need something for this. So if you just happen to be pitching Activision a shooter that will be done roughly in that time slot, like, you're much more likely for them to be like, yes. Unfortunately, they are, I don't know, the publishers, from my interaction with them, are not super great at like sharing that information. I think they don't really want it to get out there. So it's, you're kind of just, it feels like you're throwing darts a little bit. You know, you just kind of pitch to everybody, and then you hope that they can work it into their portfolio and that it makes sense for them to sign it. But Yeah, it's very hard. New IPs are even harder just because there's, you know, no established like recognition of this brand, and it takes a lot of money or buzz or PR or marketing, whatever, to get people like, you know, excited and aware that this thing even exists. So that's a big reason why those are a hard sell. And at Double Fine, we kind of like really only make new IPs for the most part. So yeah, that was a challenge. And I think that was one of the big challenges for Brazen, is that it was a more expensive game, and it was a new IP, and it was just kind of a tough sell. Yeah. But yeah, it's luck, and it's tough, and it's a lot of just repetition. You know, you'll just be just pitching to a bunch of people. And it helps, like, working at Double Fine and having Tim as, like, he's the ultimate, like, foot in the door for even for these non-Tim games, is that, you know, everybody wants a meeting with Tim Schafer, like, doesn't matter. So that was really cool that I got the opportunity to, like, pitch to just, I don't know, like, 15 different publishers. And a lot of it was just like based on Tim's reputation, Double Fine's reputation. Even though they don't know who I am, it's like, oh, well, there's a new Double Fine game. Like, cool. People are, you know, at least they want to see what it is, even if they don't sign it. So that was cool. It's just a lot of repetition, I guess. Also, like, they're all different. That's super weird. All the publishers are different, and they're all looking for different things, and they're all going to give you different feedback. And that is rough sometimes. Just that they all have their own goals, and they're very specific in what they're looking for. So like with Brazen, I got a lot of different feedback about like what they did and didn't like about it. And that sort of put us in a weird place. Like, cause you don't necessarily want to change the game, but like, you know, if everybody was giving you the same feedback, you'd be like, okay, we can maybe consider altering the design and repitch it or something. But when you get just different feedback across the board, it's like, oh man, I don't know how we would alter it, you know? So yeah, it's a weird process, you know. Money is tough to get.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's also, you know, one thing that's weird is that I think that a lot of people that are creatives, they feel, you know, like, I don't know, they're sort of like against the man and the system and the process and stuff. But, you know, looking at it, like, there's a huge amount of, like, they almost feel like entitled to money. And I just think that's like kind of a weird thing, you know, like they just assume that their idea is so great, and like, why wouldn't everybody want to pay for it? And it's like, well, there's a lot of risk, it's a lot of money, you know, you're unproven, like there's probably a laundry list of like why people would not want to sign your game. That sounds so mean. Whoever's listening to this, your game is amazing, and it'll totally get signed like in a heartbeat, so go pitch it, it'll be great.
So Chris, how'd you get started in the industry?
Well, I, similar to Brad, when he talked about having an internship and doing something temporarily, I took a job, a 2-week temporary job at what was called Lucasfilm Games at the time. And then I had been there for 2 weeks. And the man who was my boss, David Fox, said, you know, you should stay. And I said, sure. So it was very lucky. I had, I was on a break from and about to go back to school, actually. But then he said, why don't you stay here? You love games. We like you. You like us. Why don't you just stay just for a little while? You know, maybe just stay for a semester, stay for a quarter. And then it ended up being 8 years and a career. So I was very, very, very lucky to have the patience and kindness of David to kind of have me at Lucas permanently.
And how'd you go on from that?
Oh, so what I started doing was managing their, what they called product support at the time. It's basically people who would call in and either not know how to use their computers or not know, it's tech support for the game. So people, lots and lots of people didn't know how to use their computers, and it was kind of just becoming a consumer entertainment platform, right? Like we were on like people who are like, I have to upgrade my 8086 to a 286. And I was like, I will totally spend an hour on the phone helping you figure out, yeah, what a sound card is and how to install that and make it work. And
that
so
is
we
awesome.
Were very, very, we were very, very, customer focused. My philosophy, you know, I mean, necessarily now that it's such a massive industry. You know, the models have really, and also there's so much online help and, you know, you can look up anything. I mean, at that time, like, we didn't even have Alta Vista web crawler, you know, like, people didn't know how to sign on to bulletin boards or, you know, they were like, I think I might want to try this thing called CompuServe. How do I do that? So, you know, they had a phone number, they would call, and we were very, committed to doing everything we could to making sure that they had a positive and fun experience and that they had a positive experience with the Lucas companies. You know, it's at that time, you know, it's 1990, so it's what is, God, it's 25 years. So people still really believed and, you know, that concept, that notion that the meaning of what Star Wars stands for, in the same way almost like Disney. If you're going to Disneyland, you're going to have a certain experience with the people. They're going to be friendly, they're going to be helpful, they're going to be what the Disney ethos, you know, is, right? They're going to be nice. You want people to have a good experience. And it's, I think it's the same way now under Kathleen. Like, she's amazing. But at that time, you know, we were a teeny, teeny, tiny company. There were 50 people, I think. And we really, every person that we interacted with who was a consumer or customer of the games, we wanted to make sure that they were happy. You know, they were playing our games. It was a privilege. I still feel that way, that it's a privilege for us to make games for people, that anyone would play anything that I ever made. I just, that blows my mind every day. I can't believe it. You know, I feel so grateful. So it sounds like bullpucky, but it's really true.
And how'd you like start working with VO?
We started doing what we were calling talkies at the time. And so we had, we were doing samples of, well, what are we going to do and how is this going to sound? And I had some experience from a prior internship working down at Universal. That nonprofit group shared space with Universal Casting, and there were times when we were a little bit idle, and so they said, oh, well, you know this and you understand this and come and help us and hang out with us and help us, you know, sort through all this stuff. And so they needed someone who kind of was comfortable speaking with agents, was comfortable really sifting efficiently through casting tapes and knowing and being able to identify what quality acting was. They had a woman who was working there who had a radio broadcasting degree, who was really familiar with recording and recording voices and kind of what that should be from a technical perspective. I had done some, you know, I was fortunate enough to grow up in Marin and to grow up in a community of people who were sound people. So I was familiar with field recording, but in studio voice recording, I wasn't super familiar with. And so the combination of those two skill sets, we kind of moved forward and created a department. And so the first thing I ever did the casting on, fully was Sam and Max. So that was, that was amazing, with Nick Jameson and Bill Farmer, who's now like in the 7D and is the voice of Goofy, and Nick Jameson, who, you know, even into Broken Age, he played Marshall Dune, and he's just, you know, he was Dr. Lobato in Psychonauts, and he's kind of a friend of the Double Fine LucasArts community. I think he and a couple of other people have almost been in every single game. So we've created these relationships where there are some people that we work with all the time who we just adore. And yeah, it's, I don't know. So that's been amazing. And then I left in 98 to go and help on a couple of different levels, help with dealing with a lot of the, all of the licensing requests that were coming in for the prequels. And there were a lot of elements, raw elements that weren't available needed to be combined and put together in exactly the correct way. So, you know, I mean, it's I'm incredibly grateful, like, to have the trust of Ben, Bert, and to have that library to hand, and then to work with licensing to help provide the effects on an as needed basis. And then to also work with the actors on the prequels to help just make sure that, you know, the director was getting everything that he wanted from those actors. And yeah, I mean, it was amazing. And then tons and tons of clients, like everybody from, you know, EA and THQ. And sorry, they shut down your studio, Brad. And no, I was just saying, like, blah, 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 clients, blah, blah, blah. I love my clients. They're awesome. Yay. And then I worked at Ubisoft. And then I worked there for 2.5 years. Yeah, 2 years, 2.5 years. And then moved home. And then working for Telltale and Double Fine and Ubisoft. Because it's awesome when you leave and they're like, oh, but you'll still consult for us, right? And I'm like, yes.
Oh, man, that's amazing.
You're amazing. Well, because they're fabulous. I mean, they're like, there's no, like... I mean, I don't know. Like, if I'm in a place and I'm frustrated or exasperated about, you know, things that are happening in a meeting or creative choices that are happening that I think, you know, if that's something that's frustrating, it's like you always have to look at it from, like, okay, here's where we are now. Here's where this person is with whom I strongly disagree, but that's where they are. And like me making them wrong and barking at them and being like, well, harumph, 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 you know, it's like, it might feel good in the moment, but it doesn't actually help to solve the problem. And so it's like always, well, okay, so this is where this person is. I'm going to like regroup and think about how this problem can be solved, like maybe coming at it from another direction or whatever. So it's like, yeah, I mean, people, I mean, there will be places or companies where I've worked or where things, I may have had a difference of opinion or something, you know, but it's never like, because that person's a jerk face or whatever. It's like, oh, we have different opinions. That doesn't mean that we can't be friends or we can't work together.
Sometimes that person's a jerk face, though.
Sometimes that person is a jerk face. But you know what's so funny is that the people who are jerk faces are never the people who are in the long-term high positions and who advance in the industry enough to have the power to hire contractors. It's always like some like junior somebody who wants to be a senior somebody, and they get really crabby and hostile and like full of hot air and opinions and like weird alienating policy choices, and they have the power in that moment to turn the room, but then they don't end up being successful in the long term. Like when I look at people who have like these crazy super long careers, they're generally people who are like, huh, yeah, that was a fuck up. Okay, let me think about that and then come back to it. And like those are the people that, I don't know, or maybe it's just, I mean, I don't know. I'm eternally optimistic, so I'm always looking at things and looking at the best in everybody. So maybe that's just, but I mean,
that's a really good trait to have. That's a really good trait to have. Maybe. I feel like I try to be positive, but there are
no,
certain
you're super
times.
Positive.
Oh my God, there are certain.
But there are
things
some people
that, really...
that I. There are some yeah. people that I won't work with. I mean, there are one of there are two actors who are on the do not work with again list. Which in I mean 25 years, that's pretty good. Don't
that's pretty good. I think that's really good actually.
But there's only like. I mean, I can't think of an actual person that I would never work with again. Like, I'm okay.
Wait, are people
actors are people?
Actors
what
are
I'm
people.
Saying
actors
is,
are people. Come on.
Actors are people. Jesus, edit that out. What I mean is, someone like working for the publisher or developer like that. There's no like. I mean, I would have to think really, really, really hard to think about who is on a dev team that was so deeply unpleasant that I would never, ever, ever work with them again, and. I mean, I don't think there's anybody, you know, and a lot of people are, there are people who are unpleasant, but again, like they're just coming from a place of whatever's going on with them, you know, like that's like how it is to work with actors. Like, oh, someone could be a big jerk face, but it's like, well, what's going on with them and how can we get past that? Like, how can we do what we need to do, which is get this job done and do it awesomely?
Yeah.
Like, how can we collaborate?
I was going to say that as Chris and Brad, you're both two of our favorite people, and also... two of the nicest and happiest people we know in the entire industry and probably
what?
The world. But you
people
have
don't
to
respect
free...
that, though.
Like, I know.
People think that I am not super smart when they first meet me, and also like just, oh, you're just viewing the world through rose-colored glasses. And I'm like, did you see the Avengers? You know that part where the guy who's a Zen Buddhist turns around and says, here's a secret, I'm always angry? Like, this is, it's not, my love is because I've gone through flipping hell, not because I haven't. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a funny thing. Anyway, not to get off on a tangent. I don't know about you, Brad, though. Like, did you go through like dark times and then find your joy? Or are you like, nope, never had dark times. Everything's awesome.
Oh my God. I've talked about it before, but it's probably buried in like some, you know, super long interview that Two Player did that I would not subject on anyone. But yeah, I've totally talked about it before. Like, I got super depressed. It was at the end of Brutal Legend.
Mm-hmm.
I got really, really depressed because I just had like a very unhealthy association of my like self-worth with like my work worth.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and it was just like reading the reviews for Brutal Legend, like they were kind of all over the map, like mm-hmm. some were really high and some were really low. And it mm-hmm. was it was just tough. I ended up just like getting super depressed, and then that was like going right into being a lead for the first time on Iron Brigade and having no idea what I was doing. So mm-hmm. it was kind of this like perfect storm of stuff. And yeah, I just ended up getting like super bummed out. But I started going to therapy and it's the best. I highly recommend. Like,
therapy is the greatest.
Therapy is literally the greatest thing. And I try to talk about it as much as I can, like in public, because there's such a like negative stigma, in certain parts of the country.
Oh, totally. And especially as a dude.
And as a dude, that's it. You know, I've never really thought about that, but yeah,
it's horrible.
Sure, you should, you know, there's definitely that, like, you should be able to handle your own shit as a man. And I hate that. I think it's like super destructive. And,
it is.
Yeah. Like she was my girlfriend at the time, but my wife now, she really like convinced me to try it out. And oh my God, I think I've been going to the same woman who is like in my neighborhood for like 5 years now.
Yeah.
Like I go like once a week and it's the best. And it's just like, oh, it's so incredible. And that really helped me recognize like a lot of things about myself and, you know, just sort of get on this path of like feeling more like mentally healthy, I guess. And then, you know, the positivity stuff though, a lot of that, this is crazy. A lot of it came from like when Iron Brigade was like announced, and it was like, oh, we don't really have any money to promote this thing, so we should at least try to do as much grassroots stuff as possible. So like, hey, get a Twitter account, like everybody get on Twitter and start talking about it and start trying to promote it and stuff. And so I think that's when like I made my Twitter account, because I had never been like a big social media guy at all, and I was like, okay, like I'll give it a shot. And everybody's so mean. Everybody was so mean on Twitter. And I was like, this is the worst. Why do people like this? You know, it's like 140 characters of snark. I think it's gotten a little bit better. But like at the time, that's all I remembered like looking at. Like I followed a bunch of people it suggested and a bunch of people that like I felt like I should follow. And I was just like, this is just negative garbage. Like, this is amazing. So I was like, okay, I'm just, you know, I'm using this to like promote work. I'm just going to be positive. That's it. And that's where like the colon D thing started, and just like being like a super relentlessly positive person on the internet. And it was great, because it had like a positive feedback loop, like on my actual life. Like I started being more positive just like in real life, because I was trying to be so positive on the internet. And then, also, I've never really been subjected to a bunch of negativity on the internet. I think it's because it's like you get what you put out there.
Totally.
You get back what you put out.
Totally.
And so just like being super positive, I feel like it just gets reflected back. And then I don't know. It's great. So yeah, like there was definitely a time when I was super bummed out and depressed, and I sought help, and then Twitter is the best. I actually don't use it as much now. Like I'm so busy with the baby and all this relocation stuff. I feel like I'm really falling away from it. But it's just, it's good. It's nice. I don't know. The power of positive thinking is like real. It's legit. And go for it.
I think people like want to know that things are going to be okay. Like it's, mm-hmm. you know, I think people need to be reminded like, no, you are totally awesome. And like, I promise you that it's not bullshit. And like, you are super nice, and you just, it's okay. Like you just need like hugging and It's not, I mean, God, I am like, I mean, you both, all of you guys have heard me be brutally just like really acid and cutting and like say things about like people knocking down old buildings to build some press board crap, like the things that I get mad about, like architecture and lack of historic preservation and like, yeah. And, but like with humans, like, oh my gosh, they're just nice and they're nice. And physiologically, because Jordan, my beautiful husband, who I will mention in this podcast, who will listen to it. Hi, Jordan. He's a cardiac ICU nurse and, reading all the studies about our, I'm mispronouncing it, arteriosclerosis, and all the hardening of the arteries and stuff like that. Like they did all these studies about what helps people with all the complementary, like hippie medicine, like talking and therapy and like hugging and blah, 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 blah. And so they figured out like when people feel connected and they are actually like physically getting hugged or feeling loved, the chemicals that are released like help clear the arteries. So it's like, okay, we have evolved for hugging. Which is like ridiculous. People who are like, no, it's human nature for there to be like war and blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, dude, check out the study because I think you're wrong.
We're going to call this episode Evolved for Hugging.
Evolved for Hugging.
But Nick has our question.
We're not going to turn this into Massive Chalice postmortem, but since
Massive
it was.
Chalice!
Yeah. But since it was Brad's most recent story driven game he's led,
yeah.
How would you approach a story going in?
I'm not really a super big story guy, but I love, I was thinking about this, for this discussion, and I really like a good setup. Like, I really knew that I wanted to do, like, the bookend approach. Like, a lot of my favorite, like, mechanically satisfying games, they don't have much of a story. Like, I think, Diablo 2 was very formative for me when thinking about this, where it's like, you know, you really just care about the game part of the game. Like you're just in the game and it's about like your skills and your build and fighting and whatever and loot and you know, it's all these mechanics. But it's like the, you know, the setup is reasonably interesting and you get like a great cinematic on the beginning and it kind of like introduces you to the world and what the hell is going on and cool, gives you your goals and you're like, awesome. So I think that like Trench does this as well. And then at the chapter breaks, like after you defeat like major bosses or you finish like a major chunk of the game, there's like sort of another kind of you know, linear story nugget that you're given that kind of sets up the next area. And that was definitely the structure that I went with for Trench. With Massive Chalice, it was a little different because I wanted there to be a strong setup and like a lot of flavor and like world building. Like I think that's the stuff that really gets me excited about games and I guess like story in games. It's interesting that like I always, when people talk about story, I always instantly think they're talking about narrative, like jump to just like narrative and linear narrative. And that stuff does not really fire my gears so much. Is that, can your gears get fired? I don't know. But yeah, that does not like excite me as much, I would say. And there are so many of the, you know, like AAA games where it's like everybody's experience is the same or mostly the same because the game is so heavily narrative driven that it's like, it's so similar to me to like watching a movie or experience, you know, reading a book or whatever. Everybody has such a similar experience that I just feel like it's not taking advantage of what's amazing about the medium, like the interactivity and stuff. So yeah, for Massive Chalice, it was different. I wanted to try to have a strong setup and try to have good like flavor and world building stuff. But then also try to have it be as systemic as possible, the story. I wanted the story to primarily be inside the player's own head where they're elaborating on what the game is providing for them with their individual families. So in the game, you have all of these heroes and then everybody ages throughout the course of this timeline and you can marry them together and then they have kids and it's all procedural. It's like the names are procedural and they have genetic traits that are procedural and you know, they are very generic characters in that sense. But then we kind of hit you with these narrative nuggets that we call random events in the game. They're just text only, very influenced by FTL, if you play that game. It's just, you know, text, simple choices. They involve your heroes, and then you'll get these randomized outcomes. And you guys wrote all of these. Yes, there are like, I can't remember how many are in the game. There's like 30, 35, something like that in the game. And you'll get throughout the course, you know, one playthrough is probably like 12 or 15 hours, and you'll get maybe like a dozen of them throughout a playthrough, and they're all randomly, you know, they can happen at any time. And yeah, so you'll get a lot of these things, and I like it because it kind of prods you in the direction of making up the story in your own head about these families that you're kind of ushering through this battle. And it really helps it kind of, yeah, it's like the narrative cattle prod, you know, the story cattle prod that kind of hits you. And it makes you think about, you know, do you want to embellish it in your own head about like this specific family? Because, oh, this one guy went to this tournament and he emerged victorious and whatever, you know, cool. And so now he is a more interesting character in your own mind and in your playthrough. That character is now kind of marked. And the game sort of just like helps you out. But yeah, it's mostly about sort of your own story and the, you know, the moments that happen mechanically in the battles and stuff. And those are different for everybody. And I really like that like you are experiencing your own story within that world. We do bookend it. Like there was, you know, talking about the trench stuff, it is still bookended. Like the beginning of the game and the end of the game is the same for everybody. But what happens in between, and you know, it's a huge stretch of time, you know, like 12 or 15 hours or whatever, like what happens in there is like highly procedural and highly dependent on how much the player is willing to bring to it. And I'm interested in that when it comes to story stuff, like just having more things that allow you to craft your own story around what the game is giving you. I really like that stuff.
I'm curious, like, are there any, because you were talking before about the more linear games that are more like movies. Are there any of those kinds of games that you like?
Yeah, I think that I used to be more into the sort of what has evolved to be the like, you know, AAA narrative-driven kind of thrill ride game. I just think that they've become so like on rails that I don't know. I'm not as into it. I think the game, like I was trying to think about this, like the game that I really liked the most that was narrative driven was Final Fantasy II. Two in the States, I guess four in Japan. That one, I really liked it mainly because the gameplay, like your party is so linked to the narrative. So as you play that game, I don't know if you guys are familiar with that game, but as you play through it, it plays like a, you know, kind of pretty standard, what you would expect from like an old school JRPG. But as you go through the story, your party is determined by like what happens. You know, characters will die or they'll leave or they'll, you know, whatever, and your party is constantly shifting. And so the gameplay is so heavily impacted by the narrative that I think it really helps the narrative stick out in my mind when I think about it. Whereas, you know, you think about like you know, one of the Uncharted games or something where it's like that's just kind of, I don't know, you're just kind of grinding through it, you know, and getting the cutscenes. And I don't know, Uncharted is really good, so I don't know if I would use that one as the negative example of it. But you know, like I really like Call of Duty. I play the multiplayer side of Call of Duty, but the single players of Call of Duty I feel like are very much like, you know, shoot these dudes, hit this trigger, get this cutscene. It's like very very kind of like rote as you go through it. And that's not to say that they're not like exciting and that they're not interesting and they're not fun. Like they can be all those things, but it's just, they're not really like leveraging the medium to its fullest. And that always kind of like, you know, I having such limited time to play video games, it's like, I want to play the video games that are like
games.
Games, yeah, that are as gamey as possible, you know.
Yeah,
that's like weird, and that's, I feel like that's like really negative.
It's not though,
but it's just, I just think that that's where my interests lie in the medium right now, you know. But I love it, so I do really actually quite dislike it when a game will have, you know, I was talking about the other aspects of like world building and flavor and
yeah.
And dialogue and all that stuff, when that stuff is not respected in a raw mechanical game, it's a turnoff. I don't, you know, I don't like that. Like I
can
want
you give
a
an
game,
example of that.
Can I give an example of that? There's probably like really, see, that's the thing is that I'm so disinterested in those I would say a lot of fantasy. Actually, it's funny that like that was one of the big goals of Master Chalice was to not make like an orcs and elves fantasy game. I think a lot of fantasy games just go with the stock Tolkien stuff and they don't really think about it, and they don't really think about the art and they don't really think about the world. They're just kind of like, or I mean, you know what? Maybe they really are thinking about that stuff, but they're going with the sort of tropes and the what's expected, and they feel like they have to put dwarves in or whatever, you know? And it's just, it is just kind of a turnoff for me.
Do you think, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I don't want to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, I think I was just going to restate exactly what I had just said again. I think that's known as rambling. I was going to ramble. So I don't need to do that. You
can totally... Well, I have a question because it's something that always comes up in design and story meetings where using like Assassin's Creed 4 as an example, where you have or a bunch of other games where it's like you have this goal like, oh, if you don't do such and such, so and so is going to die, or maybe so and so is dying or whatever. And then there's all these side missions and, you know, it's been 40 hours and it's like, okay, well, so-and-so is dead. And then, and then you'll go do, I mean, I of course worked on Black Flag and love it and have a great time. And I mean, I love all those games and the side missions, but it's a, but it's something that like, we all know that, okay, yeah, then we're going to like go back to our origin point and the guy's going to be like, oh my goodness, it's a good thing you got here so quickly. So-and-so is almost dead. And you're like,
So you're talking about like the open world tension of like having a main quest that has urgency on it.
Right.
But then you've got like, you have all this open world where you can just do all this
stupid stuff
that has nothing to do with anything.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's a problem. Like, I think that, actually, I think that you guys talked about this on your first episode about, like, you know, is there, like, what if you had an open world game that, like, didn't have a, you know, main quest, didn't really have, like, that
or something.
Embedded narrative, or it didn't, like, spur you on. Like, I think that would be interesting. I think that would be fine, you know?
It's like, it's an endless source of comedy, like, in the meetings that I'm in. Like, we, because we're all trying to... like for future AAA titles, trying to figure out a way to solve that problem. And I guess for me, like working on Massive Chalice, what I loved so much about the fact that it was strategic, but it also had story in it, but it didn't like, it just, it felt like there was never a disconnect for me in terms of, I mean, and that's necessarily the design of the game as well, but like, thinking about larger AAA titles and that kind of, you know, having a tension that is at once believable but not ridiculous when you're actually playing through the game. Do you know what I mean? Like, there has to be, or I'm thinking you, Brad, more than anyone, and maybe you guys, Nick and Max as well, have thought about or have ideas about how to kind of solve that problem. You know, as you talk about like in Call of Duty, or as I was talking about in Black Flag, or, you know, other things, like how do you take that kind of elegant marriage of story and also the compel, like the push to action, and put that with something larger or in a larger title? Like, is there, are there ways that you think of to do that?
Oh, I don't know. Because I feel like, The thought, at least, is that players need that urgency to kind of go along and actually do the main quest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that urgency is like, it is the cattle prod that like pushes people towards that when you have all of these other things. But like, it's weird. Like, I feel like that's a very, you're not really respecting the player in that, with that line of thinking. And that super bums me out. Like, I think that people are, you know, mostly smart, and that you should respect them and respect their time and respect that they're going to do what they want to do in the game.
Totally.
And that there shouldn't be this like artificial thing that compels them to do this stuff. I don't know. I think that that is though at odds with like, you also just want it to be exciting and like having tension and like deadlines can make something more exciting. So I think that you could just sort of change the way that you look at it and try to make something that's like maybe player initiated, where there's not really a deadline. Like, I don't think that if you removed the sort of like time pressure and the deadline from the main quest, but you still knew that it was kind of like your main quest, mm-hmm. That you could do or not do, I think that people would still do it. You know, like mm-hmm. they would, and then they would feel less guilty about doing side missions like that. You don't want people to feel guilty about doing side missions. That's ridiculous.
And they would feel less pulled out of the illusion when they go and meet, right. like, you know, quest giver B, who's like, well, hello, good thing you hurried up. And it's like, oh, man, you know, it's just a, like a facepalm moment. Yeah. And the thing, like in Massive Chalice, like, and I only saw the initially saw those scripts that we recorded in the studio. A lot of that stuff would talk about moments, and those moments were, they were so tiny. It was just three lines, but it gave this kind of history and context that then pulled the player forward through player initiative, like self-generated player initiative. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel like I see that really often as a player. And that was kind of magical to me. And I just wonder, like, you guys, and also, the three of you guys, like, wow, that was rad. How did you do that?
I really like the structure of the game is that we didn't, you know, you can make a bunch of choices while time is paused, but it's a defensive game only. Like, you're not the one who initiates the fights. You just kind of set up the pieces and then let the simulation run mm-hmm. until an attack happens, and then you can engage in it or not. I think that's just like very different than, you know, you talk about Assassin's Creed or any of these open world games where you have an avatar and you're running around through it and you have to be the one to like initiate in starting the next mission. You know, like, I think that is the real difference between those games. And I mean, and there are a lot of strategy games that are like, you know, like Massive Chalice, like that, you know, you feel a little bit more pulled out and disconnected as opposed to having a character that's like running around in the environment and stuff. So I think that's part of it. But what was the other thing? Were you talking also about like those small lines? Like Nick and Max wrote, I almost just said Sam and Max. Nick and Max wrote these small, like, little, you know, it was like for winning a battle, and it would just be like, just, I don't know, it would be like a super short line about some battle that was legendary that, you know, whatever, we didn't do it. We didn't even talk about that battle. Like, there's no story Bible that talks about how great.
No,
that
there was nothing. That was
it.
Like, that.
Is that what you're talking about?
Like, yeah, that was the thing. One? Was yeah, yeah. So less a design thing and more just like creating context for people so that they felt emotionally invested. But it was like, it was literally three lines.
Yeah, yeah. Like, that's
which was crazy
that,
to me. It was.
I mean,
kind
a lot of
amazing.
It was just like
I can tell you how that all lies, came about.
You know.
Yeah, that's what I want to know, because
it was
you guys know that I'm such a huge fan of that script, and I was just like, how did you create this whole world in three lines? Like, what the hell?
Like, a lot of that came out because we had so few ways to get story across in the writing. It was mm-hmm. like mostly just the random events and the dialogue
and the cinematics.
But like, a lot of the dialogue that we were trying to get in, it was a fight between like specificity versus broadness, where if it was like way too specific about like we're gonna do a deep dive into this one battle that never happens in the game just because it helps seed the world, but if you make it too long about what happened, then people are gonna be hearing this over and over, and it's gonna get really boring really fast. But
yeah.
We still
yeah
just, like,
it's also, I feel like you guys did one of them, and it sparked, we talked about this a lot on during Trenched, is that I think that it was, oh man, I want to say that there's this one line in one of the Snake Plissken movies, Escape from New York or Escape from LA, where they reference stuff that Snake has done. You know, in one line, there's this reference to like Chicago, and like the movie's not set in Chicago. It's not, you never hear about Chicago. You're just like, what? Like, something crazy went down in Chicago. And it really like, it just lets your imagination fill in all these gaps. And it hints at like the larger story and the larger world, and which may or may not be there. And in our case, it was not there like at all. And you guys wrote one of those lines, and I was like, oh, more of these, please. Like, let's write, you know, for every three or four or five generic ones, like, let's make sure we have one hyper specific thing that talks about like one character that never, you know, that we're not even going to do any backstory or anything about. And then you just, you know, just go nuts in a couple lines and just have it really open-ended where people are like, what the hell does that mean? What is that? You know, but Yeah, it also helped, I think, that there were two characters that had the same level of, like, knowledge. Yeah. And so they were kind of talking to each other. You know, most of the time the Chalice would talk to you, but sometimes they would talk to each other. And when they're talking to each other, that gave us a great opportunities to just, like, I mean, they're really old. Like, the Chalice has been around forever, so they can talk about just shit that's happened way in the past that's just totally nuts. And they don't really have to clue you in on it.
And it's
I think that helped.
And apart from one specific random event, we don't get any history of the Chalice besides what they allude to in the dialogue. And they're just constantly trying to, like, put in the smallest of hints into their history together.
That could work on its own, but also could link with parts of the backstory that we came up with.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think the key thing of how, like, if we succeeded at what we did, just being allowed to revise everything constantly, given we didn't have a ton of time on the game, but we had enough time where, like, we were allowed to throw everything, every idea we had, just throw it out there, see if it stuck. A lot of times it didn't. Like, when I forgot who recorded our first pass of the dialogue, just put it into the game to see how it fit, but it was garbage. And we hated, like, having to go play through the game early on and just hear our terrible dialogue played back at us. And it made us so angry. Like, okay, we have to write better than this. We have to write better than this.
And it was also half the scratch dialogue that we recorded was like a robot, too, which made it sound even worse.
Yeah, we only had time to do a few lines as scratch. Like, that's not how you'd want to do things. Like, you'd want to be able to do, like, a full scratch pass, implement it all, make sure that, like, the timings are, like, gonna work, and then, like, take it and do, like, the pay for the real recordings. Part of it for us, though, is that I felt comfortable making that decision for Master Chalice specifically because, like, the characters are not lip-synced and they're not, you know, they're not moving around. They're just, like, these mostly disembodied voices in the game. So timing and animation and stuff was not as big a deal. It was not a deal, actually, for the game. So it was a lot easier to do that. But still, I wish that we had done Scratch first so that you guys could hear how it was going to be in the game specifically.
And Chris, you'd use Master Chalice as the example, but when you came on, like, what's your typical process like? And I know Master Chalice was perfect, but what were the typical problems you encounter when you were brought on?
What were the problems that I encountered on Massive Chalice when I was brought on?
Or, like, what your general usual problems are when you come on to a project doing stuff like this?
If there are typical ones.
If there are typical ones.
Well, usually nowadays, I will come on actually a little bit earlier if people need help with character motivation, or it depends on who the writer is and if they feel, I mean, you know,
what does it really mean?
It really depends. It can come on. I mean, I can come on in the very, 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 very beginning where, if people are looking for, you know, as we were talking about, there is a history, like, in the past 10 to 15 years of a lot of the narratives being, you know, for large AAA games being pretty, similar. And there's a fairly significant recognition of the fact that that's not going to keep it'll always keep a certain audience's attention, you know, in the same way that, like, you know, hardcore, like, History Channel, like, you know, stuff is going to, I mean, there's always going to be an audience for everything. That's what's amazing and awesome about games. But there's a, within the larger population, as more and more people are playing games and as it becomes more and more kind of the go-to family entertainment thing, there's a massive hunger for different stories, different protagonists, maybe instead of competition, you know, eliminate your enemies type stories, collaborative stories, just all kinds of varieties of different things. And so now people are saying, well, what are the stories that you've wanted to tell? What are the stories that you were never able to tell? Like, just come in and tell us, like, what do you want to play? Like, you've been, you know, not as a, I'm not a market research target, but as someone who's been doing this forever, who's been sitting in meetings forever, saying, well, you know, you could maybe, you know, there's a large untapped market here of people who would really love, you know, X, Y, or Z, who would really love collaborative storytelling, who would really love to see themselves represented on screen, who would really love to see, you know, maybe mysteries, who would love to see this variety of things. So people are saying, well, okay, so what can we do with that, and who can we cast for that? A lot of times now, people will, especially again in the AAA space, talk about who they're going to cast, because it is a lot of full body, full motion performance and directing. You know, we say directing is mostly casting. So it's who are people that we think about. And it's just like lots and lots of brainstorming, spitballing, and kind of getting really involved in the early stages of the process, which helps me as a director to better know what the team wants, what the team needs, what we need to achieve from a gameplay standpoint. I mean, you know, Brad was talking about really wanting to play games with a very... you know, a lot more of a very kind of approaching it from a design perspective rather than maybe from the kind of intense sort of like linear narrative perspective. And so that's something that a lot of people are really, I think, recognizing and knowing that players want, because there's so much that can be done and the possibilities really are infinite. So long answer. But coming on to, I mean, issues, if I come on to something, I mean, sometimes I'll just be handed a script like, okay, here's the actor that we hired. Here's the script. Go make it not suck. And that, you know, there's always going to be sometimes issues where if it's an actor, I mean, people, thankfully, this doesn't happen as much now as it did in the very beginning, where people would hire someone that my friend's boyfriend has always wanted to be a voice actor, and so he took a couple of classes, and so, you know, we cast him as blah. And
did that,
you know,
happen a lot back in the day? That was like very common. Yeah,
that happened. I mean,
Playing a lot of video games back in the day, it certainly felt like that happened a lot, but I've never heard.
Oh my gosh, there is a game that I worked on that has the worst reviewed, and I mean, you know, two games that I've worked on are very famous, well, not very famous, but I at least certainly am intensely aware of how grim a lot of the voices in some of the, like
how grim the voices are.
I think I get
what you're talking about.
No.
Yeah, the VO is terrible in that game.
No, yeah, right? No, Grim Fandango is a perfect, God, that thing is like a, I don't even know what that thing is. It's like living alchemy. It's perfect. So the games, one of them was like a licensed film property, and one of them was done outside of the country, and so we had people Skyping in, and so like we had unfinished art, we didn't know what the characters were supposed to look like, so the people were also non-native English speakers and really had spent a lot of time watching like spaghetti westerns and thought that like, let's have a guy who has a really high shrill voice because that's what a villain will sound like. And then the art is like this really, really deep bassy guy who's wearing like, you know, this kind of, so just that kind of like when there's a disconnect between the art and the desired voice, or when there's like infighting within a team where like the team, you've got, you know, six team members and two of them want something and four of them want something else, and so there's all this like jockeying and jostling for position, and then you don't really know who, and then I say, well, okay, is there, you know, I'll speak to the creative director and say, hey, you know, so what's really your vision for this thing? And then the creative director might say something completely different, so I do what the creative director wants, and then both the two people who wanted one thing and the four people who wanted the other thing, they hate it. And then there's six people saying, this voice that we got sucked and we hate this person and she shouldn't work for us anymore because she did a terrible job. And you're like, but I was just trying to give you what you wanted. So, you know, that's client services, right? So it's just about trying to get everybody in the room and trying to really get everybody to agree. So now I've learned like, okay, I'm going to get the six people and also the creative director in the room and say like, okay, let's figure this out. And then, like, get everybody on the same page instead of trying to, like, navigate in the midst of the process to be able to foresee, oh my gosh, okay, that's what's going to happen here. Awesome. Let's get everyone in this meeting and let's really nail down, like, this is definitely what you guys want, you know? And then at that point, if they get it and they all hate it, they can at least say, oh yeah, remember we had that meeting? Well, that didn't work. Okay, let's do something else, you know? So it's, again, like inviting people to collaborate so that you don't get those kinds of weird territory battles and kind of like creative, yeah, where everybody, you know, all the dogs want to pee on the fire hydrant, but nobody wants to take responsibility for the fact that the fire hydrant smells like pee. So like, that's like, you know, so you just try to like foresee those things, but sometimes you can't. I mean, sometimes, especially as a contractor, sometimes you can't foresee those things and you do the best you possibly can. And, for, you know, any number of thousands of reasons, it's not liked, and you just, you know, you have to just take your lumps and move forward. And I mean, definitely I always try to talk to the team and say, okay, yeah, what went wrong? Like, how could I have served you better? You know, I do a lot of, after the fact, sort of ferreting out if something went terribly wrong, like what was it? So how can I improve? How can I learn from this experience? But generally, thankfully, that doesn't usually happen. People seem to like the work that I do and hire me, which is amazing. So like, yeah. But I mean, I think in battles, territory battles within the team is hard. Characters that are not synchronous, the vision for the voice, the vision for the art, and then the vision for the writing, those the three things are disconnected. Those are problems, but you know, I try to tactfully get those things resolved. And then sometimes, I mean, it's less bad now, but sometimes there are things where people say, why doesn't she get raped? Because, you know, trauma builds character. And I'm like,
oh my God, that is okay. The worst thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, well, I mean, nobody's going to come out and say that publicly now, but they certainly did, you know?
Yeah,
so
wow.
There's a lot more. There's a
progress?
Lot more. Progress, a lot
great.
More, you know, education. People sure. are, you know, I mean, the world is becoming increasingly more and more aware of other people's experiences. I mean, God bless the internet. Like, we can learn. Oh, wow. You know what? I had no idea that slang I was using from 1920s that I thought was really funny because I saw it in a Jeeves and Wooster episode is incredibly terrible. And I cannot believe that I said that. And I know now, but holy frogs. Yeah. And I mean, it's people don't know what they don't know. So it's like, I'm not going to hate them. I'm going to be like, ooh, wow. Okay. On the inside, but I'm going to, again, like, you know, meet them where they are and be like, okay, so here's why maybe that doesn't work. Here's some studies on trauma. Let's talk about that. But that's, I mean, you know, that's getting better.
When you're in the VO studio or even when you're coming into story consult, what do you keep in the back of your head when you're working with characters or consulting on a story?
Oh, I always think about what the player's experience is going to be. That's my focus. 100%. How is the player going to experience the story? Well, coming from starting in the industry as working in product support, like it's always, always, always about the person that's in their living room, either with their kids or in, you know, a dark room in their bedroom, you know, listening on headphones. What is their experience going to be? Like that is such a massive level of trust for someone to grant me. So it's how is the player going to experience this moment? What is this going to mean to the player? And is this conveying the vision of the team? Like, is this going to work in the design the way that the design needs it to work? Is this going to convey the emotional moment that the writers have worked on? You know, I mean, you guys know your writers, like they, you know, they're 3 o'clock in the morning and they're just hating themselves staring at a blank page. Like, I'm not going to say, oh, well, hey, I've looked at this for, you know, 4 hours, I'm going to anticipate and think that I'm going to do it better. No, like, my loyalty is to the players and to the team. And so that's what I'm always doing, is trying to, like, shepherd and midwife and make sure that this thing that is being co-created by the actor and then by the team gets, you know, that the elements combine in just the right way to create something that the player's gonna enjoy, hopefully.
And speaking of, like, an obligation, Brad, did you ever feel more obligated to put more story into the stuff you worked on because you were working at Delafine? Or was that never a thing for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think so. I feel like that's probably the biggest thing that I learned at Double Fine when it comes to actually, like, game making, is that you can't, like, just... Like, I feel like I used to have that approach of, like, oh, you can totally just white box everything and it should just be fun. And, like, who cares about, like, you know, the flavor and the story and the characters and whatever. Like, that doesn't matter. You know, you it should just be good without all that stuff. But it's like the way that stuff enhances the game, you know, it, like, I don't think that I was giving that enough credit. And I think I learned a lot about that. I did feel the need, though, especially on Trenched, to put more story into the game, like, as much as we could. It's not a very story driven game, but it felt like we needed to have something there. You know, we needed it, and that was probably more than I think at that point I was still sort of like, oh, you know, we barely need anything. You know, that's like almost like a waste of money. But, you know, looking back at it, like, I'm glad that it has at least the setup and the world building and the sort of, you know, what little story there is. I'm glad that it's there and that we worked as hard as we did to make sure that it would be there. Does that answer the question? that they're just being like, I think that, especially at that point, Double Fine was the Tim Schafer studio only. You know, it's like we had done Psychonauts and Brutal Legend, and that's it. And those are both very, like, story-driven, narrative-driven games. You know, tons of characters. And, I really thought, like the studio had still not spread out to be more than just that. So I was really nervous about having it, you know... I don't know, like have shocking people too much with a mechanical game only. I was really worried about it. I think it was great, like people's reception of it and willingness to be like, yeah, this can totally be a Double Fine game too, was great. Like, I think that I was not expecting that to happen. And it's really cool that, like, Double Fine makes all sorts of stuff, and that's sort of like the brand is now about that, as well as being about, like, the Tim games. I think that's awesome. But yeah, I was a little bit worried about it. You know, I was worried about, like, not having story in it, and also, like I said, that's not necessarily what the narrative stuff is not necessarily what interests me. So getting help with that stuff is good.
I also remember we had a couple discussions, like, with you for a while, where it was like, what is a Double Fine game? Because Master Chalice is a pretty, at times, a very serious game. And we were, like, trying to figure out, do we tone that down? And what is a Double Fine game? And I think we decided it was a certain...
It's more about the characters.
About the characters, and then there's a certain brand of humor that can be more welcome there.
Yeah, and I think that having... And that's where I think that settling on this, like, oh, it is... The setup is very serious, and there's a lot of, like, really... intensely dire, serious things that happen, but then there's also, like, it gets undercut with, like, weird humor, like the ostrich event where, there are just, like, a lot of, like, bizarre things that happen that are strange, and that strange weirdness and humor can undercut the seriousness of what is happening. Like, yeah, bringing a little bit of levity, the fact that, like, everyone's gonna get old and die. Was really good, and I think it helped make it feel more like a Double Fine game.
Yeah.
Chris, because you've had a lot of experience working with very, very big studios, and you're dealing with lots of performance stuff at VO, how do you stay consistent with your directing?
Do you mean, like, on something on the Old Republic, where...
Yeah, Yes.
Where it's 300,000 lines, or I think it's more by now.
Yeah, on a project of that scale.
Well, it's always about the character, you know, like if you're true to the character, then that's what matters, you know, it's something whether it's episodic like Minecraft, story mode, the Telltale game, when we had a lot of, you know, maybe different event changes, different iterations of what was going to happen in the game. It's as long as you have the character set, that's the thing. Is this true to the character? And that really helps the writers once they know and once they understand, and kind of once we do our first establishing passes with the characters, the writers actually will sometimes then re-listen to those voices and think, you know, can I imagine this voice saying this line? And it becomes a really kind of a very collaborative, like hand in hand, sort of back and forth type of conversation where the writers are writing for the actors, and the actors are understanding the writer's intentions because they, you know, it's so neat. Like a lot of the voice actors, they really want to understand how it works in the game. And they really, you know, some of them don't. Those people tend to be more commercial talents who then we use as like ancillary characters. But people, you know, certainly like Jennifer Hale, people like Troy, who plays, you know, Troy Baker, who games a bunch, or Scott Porter, who's amazing, who is, you know, constantly, he's just God, like we would just spend, if we finish something early, then we'd spend the next 20 minutes just like he could go and I could go and we could be like, oh, thank you so much, we finished early, yay. But no, we'd spend like 20 minutes just nerding out about what he's playing and what I'm playing. And so there's a lot of voice actors who really, really care about games and who really want to understand the structure of how they work. So it's, I mean, you know, when you have the character consistent, you know, using, I mean, we all know, well, what, you know, I don't know, what would Twilight Sparkle, like, would Twilight Sparkle, she's in a character created by Tara Strong for My Little Pony Friendship is Magic, like, would she ever lose her temper, and would her voice ever get, you know, like, no, like, she's gonna lose her temper, she's gonna freak out, but then she's gonna maintain her calm, cool, collected thing. So it's really just like, once you understand your character, I'm rambling, yeah, okay.
I have a follow-up. Since you've literally been at the beginning of voice in video games with LucasArts, and then you've come all the way through, so you're working with performance artists and even motion capture stuff. Mm-hmm. Where do you see the performance going forward in video games?
Oh, well, did you guys play Infinity Blade on the iPhone? Infinity Blade 3?
I played the first one.
It's amazing, dude. Oh my God. It's like a console game on your phone. It's ridiculous. It's crazy and awesome. So that's fantastic. And it has, of course, fantastic voice work. Yeah, it's great. So I think that it's going, and with augmented reality, like there's Oculus, but there's also like Magic Leap, and there's also like the Microsoft, you know, holodeck stuff that they're like, mm-hmm. I mean, there's all this different stuff, and who knows what Valve is doing.
I don't know either. People are asking me and I'm like, I can't even not tell you because I don't know.
Acting is acting, right? So quality acting is quality acting, and that is whether it's on stage at the Globe or whether it's in front of a microphone, you know, it's are you inhabiting that character? Is that inhabiting you? Are you being absolutely true in that moment? Because if you're bullshitting, people can tell, and that's what bad acting is. So I think that comes through intensely in the voice, and as we're looking at performance things. I mean, I just think, like, how incredibly cool would it be if I had some kind of AR something where, you know, I can say to Cortana, who's standing in my living room, like, okay, do this, and she's standing right next to me, like, what? That's amazing, you know? So I think it's just about getting, you know, that in terms of technology. I think that it's just going to become like maybe more personal. But I also think that there will always be a place for straightforward, like, voiceover only. I mean, there's going to be a place for the kind of ambient, like, nature of, like, the found items. You know, we were talking about Sarah and how much we all love her, you know, in Gone Home, Firewatch. You know, it's all, a lot of it from what I've seen is done over the radio, and that's very dependent upon people being able to convey emotion with no, you know, no visuals, almost, you know, the visuals of the scenery. So I think that there's, I mean, if a voice actor or wannabe voice actor is listening to this, I mean, I really think that the possibilities and opportunities are just going to get larger and larger, and for everything, you know. I mean, people ridicule the Kardashian game, and they ridicule Candy Crush, and, you know, oh, it's just a little voice where, you know, the person says, like, yippee, or, you know, you want a thing or whatever. But I've done, even for the Peanuts games, like we did, there's the iPad, you know, Peanuts circus game or whatever, and casting those little kids for that stuff, people love it, like, and then watching kids play it, and it's just very simple, tiny little verbal cues that are triggered, but it helps to fill out that world so that people feel like, oh, well, I'm interacting on a friendly level with some, you know, program that's giving me the opportunity to solve puzzles. So I think it's, if anything, it's just getting larger and larger, and the diversity of how voice will be used to enhance these products is going right along with the diversity of the products themselves.
Brad, kind of the same question, where it's just like a lot of our guests on the show we had before, and we've talked about this already, believe that systemic and procedurally based narratives are going to be a lot more prevalent in the future for the industry, mm-hmm. and that linear narratives are not going to go away, but they'll definitely dwindle. Do you see that happening too, or do you see anything else rising up?
That's interesting to me. I think the VR stuff is going to be really interesting to keep an eye on, just because some of the most compelling VR demos I've seen are, like, having a character right up in your face. Like, I think it was the Oculus one, their, like, Crescent Bay tech demo they were doing. It's just, like, a bunch of, like, little vignette scenes. And one of them is, like, this weird, like, alien guy that's just kind of right, you know, 3 inches from your face. And it feels like, you know, when you're sitting close to a monitor and you're presented with, like, I'm thinking of, like, I don't know, like Civilization or something, where you, like, you go to your advisor and it's like, it's just a full screen character, and, like, you're sitting close to your monitor. It doesn't feel like you're super close. Like, compare that to this, like, having a character in virtual reality, like, right up in your face. It feels like you are so much closer to that character, and it feels so much more, like, intimate and personal. So I think that will be an interesting place for VO and, like, full performance capture and stuff to get showed off in a way that it really hasn't in the past. So I think that will be really cool. Other than that, though, like, I just hope that the quality consistently goes up, you know? Like, I think we're just going to be seeing a lot more. I was just going to say more of the same. That's not what I mean. But, you know, it will be used kind of like what Chris was saying. Like, it will be used in the way that it's being used now. I just want to see, like, the writing get better. I want to see everything get tighter. I feel like that's a big thing. You know, I was sort of bagging on the sort of AAA stuff, the more, like, linear thrill ride stuff. A lot of it is that these games are so long. Like, if you sat down and you were going to watch, like, a 12-hour movie, like, it would not be super tight. Like, it just wouldn't, by definition, because it's huge. It's insane. So I guess I would like to see things, if they're going to be like that, just, like, make them a lot tighter. So that there can be more, you know, if there are fewer lines of dialogue, you can kind of spend more of your budget on each line, and you can hopefully get the quality up, and, you know, just better writing, better VO, better direction, better everything, so that you're just having an experience in terms of performance and emotion that more rivals other mediums, you know? That's really what you're going for. I just don't think, and it's always funny, like, I remember GTA 5, there were people talking about how it's like, oh, there's, like, Oscar quality performances. I don't think there were Oscar quality performances in that video game, you know? Like, I hope that that's not, like, a super I'm glad that you laugh, Chris. Like, I hope that that's not, like, a controversial thing. Like, it's very good for the current state of the art, but it's like, we've got a long way to go when it comes to like really conveying emotion and like being something that, that moves people, you know? So I would just like to see a more of a focus on that, I guess. Cause I think that there's so much going wide. Like Chris, you mentioned the Star Wars online game that had like just an insane amount of VO. Like that's just a crazy amount of VO. You know, like how can it must be so hard to keep the quality up for that entire thing and make sure that that's just like mind blowing.
Have to really keep your energy up too, because a lot of the times the actors, you know, they get tired or they don't know what it is, or it feels sometimes things can feel meaningless to them. They're like, oh, okay, great, here's 30 different deaths. And so like then right. You'll get like the one death, which will be, you know, like killed by an axe, killed by a saw, killed by a cat, killed by a dolphin, killed by a whatever, you know. And so you're like sitting there, you were in traffic for an hour, you know, the actor was in traffic for an hour. They're tired. They haven't had coffee. They have to go to the bathroom. They've got often like four, not to say like... they're being directed by a committee. I'll just say that instead of like, mm-hmm. you know, and so, I mean, not on Star Wars, but on other games on which I've worked in, and, you know, they're tired. And so they're like, okay, being killed by a dolphin. And, you know, they're exhausted. And often like you'll see now in the union thing, like they're being made to yell, for hours. And it's just, they're in a really, really bad situation. So it's hard to, just expect that they're going to give their best without having someone trained and who cares and who is passionate and who understands actors in the room, like they're with them, walking with them. You know what I mean? It's like taking like a pregnant person and just leaving her in a bush and being like, okay, you figure it out. You know what I mean? Or like having like four like junior teenagers like looking in the bush and being like, you're doing it wrong. Like it's not like you need somebody there who's like, I'm with you, we're gonna do this, we're gonna make it happen, we're gonna get it out, you know. And it's so it's really, I think a lot of the a lot of the actors, you can hire fantastic, amazing, wonderful actors, but without everything there, you know, the support that they're used to having in order to help them get to the place they need to get to,
right,
they're going to be wasted.
I also wanted to point out that for those people that haven't had the pleasure of working with Chris, that the process, Chris is the only person who talks to the actors in the room, because like if anyone had to record something on their own, like having three different people talking in their head about different directions would be terrible. And before, like when we were sitting down, Chris was like, okay, I want to be the only one talking to the actors, and you'll hear me describing to get them in, to give them direction. You'll hear me say things that might be completely wrong about the game, but it's okay. It's going to help them work. If you have a note, you can tell me and I'll tell them. And that was so much fun to be a part of, just like watching you try to describe what Master Chalice was like. You were using like trading card analogies.
Totally. Well, because Simon had never played games. He doesn't play games. And so often, yeah, with some actors, they don't know. And so you have to just work with, like, no matter who. I mean, some actors will come in and they're people who used to be on the radio who are no longer on the radio, and they have a fantastic voice, but they're not passionate about games at all. Or some people will come in and they will read the script and they won't like the script because they'll feel that the script portrays them, the actor, as something that they don't want to be. Like if it's an actor who's like, they're always doing these like really macho, like strong guy kind of roles, and then the role that they're being asked to do is maybe a little bit more of a like secondary kind of softer character, they might struggle with that as an actor. And so it's like working with them to find something in the character that then they can hook onto, and then that's going to be like, you know, it's like Velcro, right? So you got to find like, okay, this the actor's the fuzzy side. I have to find exactly the right size hook that's going to like stick to them, so then they have this kind of safety, and also that they have like an emotional anchor that they can come back to and understand it. Otherwise, you know, it's just like throwing them out in the deep end and letting them drown and say like, oh, well, it's because you're a bad actor. It's like, well, no, it's because you didn't give them what they needed in order to survive. Like if I'm not giving them like water wings and, or, you know, whatever the thing is that they need, That's not very...
It's water wings. That's what they need.
That's very nice.
That's the thing they need.
You know, they're putting themselves out there. It's terrifying to be in front of the mic. On Brutal Legend, I was like, we had these guys to rap bar first. And I forget who it was, one of the actors, and they were trying to barf rats, and they were not doing a very good job. And so I was trying to, like, be enthusiastic and encouraging, you know, like, about, and the rats, and it's in your belly, and blah, blah, you know? And they were like, well, you come in here and barf rats. And I was like, okay. And so, I went in there, and I made rat barfing sounds, and they were terrible. And the actor was very amused and felt like they weren't alone. And that was the thing. And then they went back in there, and it was like that shyness that they had about doing something ridiculous was gone, and they did, and then they did a great job, and it was because they were shy in that moment and they didn't understand what a rat barfer was. And so it's like, you know, I'm absolutely willing to do it first because it's not foolish, like they're trusting me, you know. So I don't know, anyway. Okay, tangents.
You, since you work both in film and video games, what has kept you in games?
Because they're games. No, oh my gosh. I mean, what wouldn't keep me in games? Because they're the best. No, I mean, I don't know. I love them to death. And I don't know. I mean, I would absolutely do film. But I really, really, really love voice actors. I love working with voice. I think that it is, you know, Jennifer Hale says it's not just acting, it's acting on steroids. And I know I said that in the DF documentary as well, but it's true. I would work absolutely, in film if someone wanted me to. I'd be delighted to do that. And I've made like indie films and, you know, but it's, for me, the power of the human voice is really where my interest lies. If I was going to do something that wasn't games, it would probably be closer to theater directing, because that is also absolutely contingent upon the reality of the human voice. So that's really, you know, I'm a sound and audio based person. I appreciate beautiful shots and structure and cinematography, but I really am very passionate about sound and sound, you know, landscapes and yeah.
Excellent.
And Brad, as you said on the podcast earlier, you're not primarily a narrative guy, but working at Dolphine, did you learn anything about narrative development when it comes to making games? And also, is there anything that still confuses you about creating a story-based game?
Oh man. I'm confused all the time. That's the first thing. Like, I feel like, because it's, you know, there's so many other aspects of like game development, I've kind of just like left that to the experts, kind of thing, you know? Like, because I feel like you can't, I am at some point like more of a jack of all trades, master of none kind of game developer at this point, but I feel like that is one of the things that I spent the least time trying to master. And also, it's like, you know, being working with Tim for so many years, it's like, well, that part's covered, you know. It's like, I don't really need to learn about an aspect of the game production that doesn't necessarily interest me, because we have, like, you know, one of the foremost experts in the field, like, doing it. So, plus, I felt like the games that we were working on, like, they needed help in other areas, you know, like, Tim doesn't really, he's not like a combat designer or whatever. So it's like, I could focus my energies more on that. Yeah. So what confuses me about it? A lot of things. Like, I guess I did learn, just kind of by osmosis, I learned about like the process. Tim's process is interesting, because he's a huge procrastinator. And he only does, Chris is well aware of this, Tim is a procrastinator, and he like writes, you know, it's like he needs deadlines, and he like writes stuff at the last minute. And he's like, I don't know. I just feel like he just kind of waits for those bolt of lightning inspiration things. And then he just like goes, and yeah, it's just like, it's not a very transferable skill, I don't think. But yeah, just kind of like working on Psychonauts and seeing the process of how it comes together. Like, I don't know like if I could really sit down and like make a narrative driven game. I don't think that I could. Primarily, I think it's just because that's not like how I want to creatively express myself, you know? Right. Like that's not really like my wheelhouse of like, oh yeah. Plus, you know, the other thing is kind of almost like seeing the horrors of it. Like just seeing how expensive it is. Like I feel like I was tasked, you know, to make games with pretty, actually very small budgets when you factor in things like VO and animation and all these things that you need to bring a more narrative driven experience to life. So yeah, I feel like I'm a little gun shy about going near that stuff. You know, it's like if you're going to have a small budget, I'd rather spend it on the gamey parts of the game and make sure that part is kind of front and center and the part that people love about it. Yeah, so I don't know. I really don't think I would be capable of like just doing it. Like I would hire good writers like you guys, and I would hire a good VO casting director like Chris. And you know, it's like just having those aspects like offloaded so that I can focus on the other parts of the game. Like I think that is my style. And then but I do like the like when we hired you guys, we did a lot of like the world building stuff, and I am definitely into that. Like I enjoy
that. Yeah, I was gonna say you're very good at that.
Because thank you. I like it. It's cool, and I feel like I think that is the biggest takeaway from like my time at Double Fine and what I learned from Tim and everybody else there is like how you can integrate when you have a top down. We have like a bottom-up design meeting a top-down design kind of in the middle. And what I mean by that is that you have like, okay, you know the mechanics that you want for this specific character, say, you know, how they're going to play in the game. And you've thought of that first and you're approaching it from the low-level mechanics. But then you also have like a high-level design of like what's the motivation of the character and what's their visual style and all this stuff. And when those two things can sort of meet each other halfway, I think that you end up with something that is like a lot more cohesive and like resonant to people. It's like super awesome. And I feel like Chris, you even mentioned a couple of things when you're talking about that horrible game, that was made out of the States or whatever, where like just those things are not lining up because the team's not in sync. There isn't a clear vision for like, what should this character be? Mm-hmm. And I think like what kind of voice that character should have is a big part of it as well. You know, it's like that goes hand in hand. It's like you really need to have like a strong vision for that. And in this, you know, in this case, I'm just using the example of like character design, but there's so many other aspects that having like a strong vision that goes through the whole thing and that you can meet it. Yeah. You can have the mechanics meet the aesthetics. Like, I think that is really the most important thing that I'm like taking away from it. Yeah. Just how important that stuff is and how much it allows people to relate to things, and it excites them about it. I think eventually, like as people play a specific game a lot, they tend to strip away the aesthetics and stuff, and they're just like really, you know, getting down and dirty with the mechanics of the game. But when they're new to the game, they are not doing that. They're just wholly experiencing the aesthetics mostly. And those things have to be there. They have to be awesome. Like, the world has to be interesting. The characters have to be cool. The voices have to be great. Like, the writing has to be good. Like, all that stuff has to be there. To sort of, like, you know, even in the case of the mechanically mechanical gamey game, like, I think it's great if all of that stuff is there, too. Just because it, like, helps you ease into the game and really, like, cozy up to the mechanics. You know? That is a long answer.
But a great one.
It's a great answer.
That was a great one to end it on.
Oh, end it on, yeah.
So we'll close it out with just for our listeners, Chris and Brad, could you both let people know where they can find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter at KBA Voice, and you can at me and say, what's up? Chris Brown, and I'll say hello and write back to you.
I just want to do that right now. That sounds awesome.
And if you go to, I think, yeah, that's probably the best way, unless you are a wiener dog troll person, in which case you will get blocked. But nobody like that would ever listen to your podcast. So.
No, they would not.
Yeah, I am mostly on Twitter, at Mr. Mooear, MrMooear, on the Twitters. You can get me there. You can also, BradMuir@gmail. That's pretty simple. Send me an email. Hopefully I'll see it. I'll see it. That's like my personal email. Please don't abuse that.
You should probably please omit don't that, abuse dude. That.
But see, nobody would do that. Nobody would do that who's listening to your podcast, so it's fine.
Exactly.
Also, you can also just guess. That's my email.
Oh, and you can find, I'm Nick. You can find me at Twin Made Films on Twitter.
And I'm Max. I am Max Folk Max on Twitter. And the podcast is Script Lock Cast on Twitter. And that's going to do it. Thank you both so much for coming on and being our guests today.
Thank you for having us. It was awesome.
Yeah, this is great.
We love you both. Hopefully we'll have you on as future guests in the future.
We love you too.
Yeah. Oh, man. This is like, oh, I'm so happy right now. Okay.